I knew depression was real, but until I felt the weight of it, I underestimated its grip. I rebounded with a toxic man who eroded the world Brett and I had built together, and when we broke up, it all came crashing down. I lost 30 pounds within 3 months. In an instant, I was disposable and unworthy of care. So I just stopped. I stopped going to my classes, I stopped eating, and I started running. It was all I could do. The thought of going to my classes, of speaking to or engaging with others, horrified me. Everything I ate tasted like paint chips. Silence made me feel like I was already dead, so I played movies until I fell asleep, but I stopped listening to music because every song made me feel too much. I'd never stopped listening to music before. One night, my friend Trent came over and force-fed me blackberry jam on rice cakes. We met at the tail end of his divorce, yet I was the one crying and having food stuffed down my throat because I hadn't eaten in days. We were both split with sadness, but caring for one another lit us up again. We dealt with our grief in different ways. He clung to the hope of his wife returning to him, and I stopped eating. In moments, I wondered if our entire friendship was built on a foundation of heartbreak and self-sabotage. I'd seen it happen to other friends, and I was wary of anyone who would feed my melancholy or demand I feed their own. But he made me feel safe, and I tried to return the favor. My friends were there for me in the best way they knew how, but they didn't fully understand. They were trying to love me as much as I was trying to stay alive, maybe even more. But I hadn't told them everything, and so they were working with only a part of me. I hadn't told them I'd been bad and that Brett had made me good. I hadn't told them about the shed and that Brett had led me away from that part of my life. I hadn't told them I had a father I loved more than anything who wasn't there because of something I could never forgive. Brett was me, because being me was too much sometimes, something I'd forgotten until that part was ripped away. Chapter 25. I fell into my junior year of college. My life was happening with my hands on the steering wheel, and I couldn't stop remembering that Brett had been the one to teach me how to drive in the first place. I started wearing layers upon layers of clothing, trying to hide whatever this mess was hanging from my bones. I'd spent 6 years measuring my physical self-esteem by a man who didn't want to have sex with women. When I awkwardly asked him about it, he'd explain, "Being attracted to men doesn't mean the parts don't work." He went on to say that even though women could sometimes arouse him, he didn't actually desire women. What I heard was, "Yes, sometimes I can get it up, but I never actually wanted you." Because it was him, and because I'd divorced myself from my own perception of my body long ago, I heard what I thought was true. And I believed it. By winter, I had tried and failed to find someone else to tell me what to think of my body and went back to Fort Wayne to spend Christmas with my grandmother. She'd gotten me a Kodak digital camera, knowing I'd always loved taking pictures of my family and friends. But I'd become so isolated, I was only interested in taking photos of myself. I brought the camera back to the house I shared in Muncie with 4 other girls. Learned to use the timer, and posed. I felt free to pose in ways I wouldn't be if the pictures were for public consumption. I posed like I was gorgeous, in outfits I no longer wore outside. And eventually, I posed for myself nude. Once I'd uploaded the photos to my computer to get a closer look, I noticed something. Where I'd seen a woman unworthy of being desired, was actually an attractive girl. My skin was clear and smooth. my breasts full and lovely. Even my stretch marks looked like an artist had drawn them just so over my hips and thighs. I couldn't stop looking at the photos. The stomach I thought came out too far looked soft and begged to be caressed. Soon, I was obsessed. I started taking more nude photos of myself, playing with lighting, being half-clothed, and even writing things on my body. I pored over the pictures using editing software to change tints, highlighting, and shadows. Over the next semester, I fell in love with my body. I loved it the way it had always meant to be loved, ferociously and compassionately. I did not like the way I looked every day, but I loved myself. Most of my life, I've been surrounded by well-dressed women. My grandmother was a cosmetologist and seriously fashionable old lady, and her daughters followed suit. When I was small, I bent to her will easily. She could dress me however she saw fit, even when it meant I looked like a 7-year-old going on 60. As I got older, I wanted to assert my own style, which posed a problem because I didn't have any style. Grandma would shake her head at me and say, "Someday, baby, you'll really understand how to dress. I'm just going to pray on that for you." For her, style was all about following rules. There was no room to be playful. Because I couldn't see how I fit into those rules, I refused to play the game. There was no way my mother would be able to afford to keep me decked out in trendy clothes, schedule regular hair appointments, or teach me how to use makeup she didn't wear. It doesn't take long for children to teach themselves not to want what they've already learned they won't have. I couldn't find a good enough reason to torture myself by acknowledging my futile desires for more stuff. For many years, I just didn't try. The few times I did, for special occasions or at the behest of my grandmother, felt unnatural and like everyone could see how uncomfortable I was in my skin. Even if I looked glamorous in the moment, it seemed I was out of my body and keenly aware of everyone else's eyes on me. Being on anyone's radar because of how I looked made me feel like I was only seconds from ridicule. Even if I had no real interest in wearing the right clothes the right way, I didn't want to be made fun of for not even knowing how. Those rare moments were reminders I could dress the way they did if I wanted to. The day after, Grandma would be praying the look would stick, and I would be browsing fashion magazines, lamenting my inability to put those looks together on my body. Then I met Spencer. He was the most glamorous person I'd ever seen. The first time I met him, he was in 5-inch heels and a pencil skirt, his curly brown hair dancing around the crown of his head. His makeup was minimal, like he put in effort, but knew he was already working with a better than solid foundation. I was walking through the atrium on our college campus when I spotted him. He was sitting alone at a table, reading, and sipping a drink in an impossibly pretty way. I sat down beside him and said, "I'm sorry to bother you, but I think you're beautiful." He blinked his bright blue eyes several times before revealing his equally bright teeth to bless me with a smile. "Thank you," he said, and offered his hand as if it should be kissed. My lips brushed his knuckles. We bonded over our mutual inclination to burst into song, appreciation for good off-campus food, and an enduring love for Dr. Maya Angelou. Spencer vowed to help me feel glamorous, and I vowed to remind him how beautiful he was every chance I got. We moved in together. Living with Spencer was like living with a human paradigm shift. He didn't just dress up or put his face on. He played. He didn't wear traditionally feminine clothes every day. He didn't shave every day. But he was always beautiful because he wanted to be. He introduced me to real makeup. He could make me look pretty in 1,000 different ways, and still, none of them felt like me. He would go through my closet with me, picking out clothes I never wore and forcing me to spin them into something new. Sometimes I looked like me, but I also looked like I was trying, and I was still afraid of looking like I was trying, even if it was fun. He did inspire me to keep searching for my look, so I did, privately and mostly only with him. Some nights when we sat in my room, watching our favorite childhood movies, he'd tell me how cute he'd been as a child, and I would remind him how cute he still was. Then he'd ask why I couldn't be that nice to myself. Eventually, I couldn't even fake an answer, so I just stayed quiet. For the first time, I was in a space where no one would bat an eye if I chose to play. And I played. I bought lipsticks and watched tutorials and let myself try things on that I assumed didn't work for my hips. I tried filling in my eyebrows. Spencer was always there to offer help and encouragement. And tweezers, which only happened once, but emotionally, I still bear the scars. On a trip home, I took a sweater from my grandmother's closet. It was something I loved but would have been afraid to wear before. It was black with silver buttons that clasped all the way up to my chin. The sleeves were 3/4 length and cape-like. It smelled like her. I wore it with a bright lipstick, one that was now part of my look. I sent the video to Spencer later, and he replied with a simple and affirmative, yes. Chapter 26. I hadn't lived under my mother's roof in 7 years, nearly to the day. We had phone check-ins every other week, with the time between calls sometimes stretching further, but never so long that I felt ignored. For the most part, the calls were fun. My mom was fun. She'd always been a good time when she wanted to be, and that had been true for as long as I could remember. Her laugh was familiar to anyone present long enough to have heard it once, and that didn't require too much time. She looked for reasons to laugh, and when she couldn't find them, she made them up herself. At any point on any day, it was not uncommon to hear my mom giggling after her own jokes from one side of our 3-bedroom ranch to the other. It had been longer than usual since our last call, but I wasn't worried until my grandmother rang instead. I was standing in the middle of a room that wasn't mine. It belonged to the family I babysat for. Her voice came over the line and spoke words, but I was too numb to really hear anything beyond my mother being in the hospital with a ruptured appendix. I was still holding the disconnected phone in my hand, what seemed like hours after my grandmother had hung up. It struck me that if my mother died, I would become some version of an adult orphan. My father was not dead, but he was unavailable to me. Did orphans have to be children? Still, if my mother died, and I was pretty sure she was dying, it seemed there should be a name for my new place in the world without her. I was not a child. I wasn't ready to become an orphan. The thought of my mother's laughter, the thought of never hearing it again, brought me back into the present as I stood there staring into my phone's waiting screen, trying to decide what to do with what I'd just been told. I hoped it would light up again with a simple text saying this was a mistake, a misunderstanding. My grandmother tended to exaggerate, especially in moments that were already pretty high stress. How many times had she forced my brother and me into bathtubs, covering us with a mattress to protect us from Midwestern tornadoes that never touched down within a 15-mile radius? Didn't we constantly joke about the time she yelled, "Run, they shootin'!" after a car backfired on the corner and almost tripped my pregnant mother in the process of seeking safe refuge in the house? I felt a bit of hope. Grandma exaggerates. Everybody knows that. I took stock of what I knew. I tried to wrestle my emotions into submission and make sense of this situation. I knew my mother was in the hospital and that she hadn't been well. I knew my grandmother had a tendency to make everything sound worse than it was. I also knew my grandmother. Her voice, tired and deliberately steady, betrayed what she refused to say out loud. I thought of her words again. When she said, "They're still trying to figure out what's going on with her," I heard, "It's not good." "She should have come to the hospital 5 days ago." I heard, "It's too late." "You should probably come see her." I heard, "Come say goodbye to your mama." A quick Google search did nothing to ease my growing anxiety about my mother. Most of what I read were personal accounts in which the patient said the pain caused by a ruptured appendix felt as bad as giving birth or getting shot. My hand came to the place I thought my appendix might be, just to the right of my navel. Most people seek professional help immediately, the pain being too great to bear for long. And yet, when my mother's appendix burst, she lived with the pain for 5 days. I imagined her doubling over during the actual explosion of the sour organ inside. Her face almost exactly like mine, but with a slightly wider nose and smaller eyes, screwed up in agony. Her body, around 200 pounds, shapely and solid, crumpling under the weight of screaming nerve endings. I could almost see the peak of her brows reach for her hairline, her eyes widening with pain and fear. I knew the looks of my mother the way most people do, like the backs of my hands, which sometimes still surprised me with scars and moles I'd swear I'd never seen before. It would be easy to convince someone my mother waited so long because she didn't want to miss work, or perhaps couldn't afford to. Maybe she didn't have health insurance and was afraid of what that hospital bill might look like when this all turned out to be gas or something. Those would still be bad reasons not to go to the hospital, but ones easily understood, especially by anyone who has lived with or lived through that specific brand of economic anxiety. There's nothing like avoiding the doctor because you can't afford it, but avoiding the doctor because you don't trust them comes close. I come from a people of broken bones that were not set or cast, only weathered. A lot of that had to do with money. That was not the case with my mother. She had sick days available, and she had good insurance. If either of those reasons were why she didn't get help earlier, I might have been less angry. Or maybe not. When it comes to my mother, I have always needed less than a nudge to find myself full and hot with self-righteous anger. And when I catch myself being angry that way, I've usually found a way to blame her for that too. When I was in the third grade, a kid in my class missed a few days because his appendix burst during recess. He and I were both playground floaters who refused to spend our precious time racing boys who pushed you down when you won, or double-dutching with girls who pushed you down when you tripped over the rope one too many times. He and I were swingers, and as soon as we'd hear that whistle that released us to play, this kid and I would run straight to the swings and start pumping our legs as hard and as fast as we could, calling out to our classmates, asking for at least one big push to get us started. My second favorite part was swinging so high, the chains attached to my seat would buckle with slack in midair and pull taut as I fell back to the world, snapping my whole body to attention and forcing my legs to sway from side to side to regain control on the way back up. My favorite part was the midair dismount. You'd only get about 3 good ones in before some teacher said it was unsafe and stopped you. But this kid, on his first dismount, landed on his feet, then began to scream like he'd shattered himself inside to stick the landing. The only male teacher on the playground scooped the kid up in his arms and ran to the school nurse. The rest of us stood around, wondering what had happened to him. As usual, the adults told us nothing. One teacher blew her whistle at those of us still standing in a circle around the place he'd once stood. "You're wasting time," she yelled. "He's gone. Go play." I left the swings. The whistle-happy teacher now stood next to them, reaching out and grabbing those of us who were going too high or looked like we were about to jump. Of course, that meant me. I walked to the older side of the playground where I could be on my own. There were a set of monkey bars there where I liked to hang and dream. My mother said my dad liked to do the same thing when he was here. Go to parks and playgrounds, lie in the grass, and dream. I tried to picture him with me, but found the image tough to conjure in a real way. I didn't know what it was like to lie beside my dad in grass or anywhere else. Still, I tried to call the false memory forward. My attempt was interrupted by the sound of the teacher who'd taken the kid inside talking to another teacher about calling 911 for the nurse. I remained quiet. I wanted to hear this. The talking teacher began to cry a little and asked his colleague, "Did you hear him scream?" She shook her head, "No." "I still hear it," he said. "What the fuck makes a kid scream like that?" My mother didn't call 911. She didn't ask for help and continued to go to work while pieces of her appendix floated off into parts of her body where doctors would never be able to retrieve them. She did this because she was afraid. Afraid of hospitals? No. Afraid of doctors? Not really. My mother was afraid that the pain searing through the middle of her body was a sign of something else, something more sinister than an infection. The demon of sickness would finally bring to fruition her worst nightmare, losing her children. My mother was afraid that she would go to the hospital, find out that she was dying, and her children would be left alone. Orphans. This had always been her second worst fear, the first being, of course, that one of her children would die before she did. This was the one I understood. I often awoke in the middle of the night, sweat slick from my siblings dying in nightmares. When I lived at home and had these nightmares, I would find Nikki or Jorian and slip into bed beside them. I would watch them breathe for as long as it took to settle the thump, thump, thumping anxiety knocking around my chest. Since we haven't lived together, it's become repeated phone calls. Any one of them might answer by saying, "Damn it, Ashley," then hanging up, knowing their voice was all I needed to hear to comfortably return to bed. My mother's fear is similar, though perhaps more intense. This overwhelming fear nearly cost her her life and almost made me the orphan of her nightmares. Yes, I was angry. By the time my mother admitted to the need for treatment, her blood was already teeming with bacteria. Septicemia, the internet informed me. Blood poisoning. Normally, people who experience septicemia can barely function due to its symptoms. I only know one other person who has ever experienced it, and he said the vomiting alone nearly drove him insane with pain. My mother was still going to work. This is how her fear had always operated. It animated her. When there was little left to motivate going through the motions of life, her fear of being judged, embarrassed, or told something is irreparably or fatally wrong with her body or mind pushed her forward. In some cases, it also pushed her children away. But when you're a single parent, you take your wins and accept your losses. My mother's fear kept her children fed, clean, and housed. It kept one foot in front of the other. For the most part, up until this point, my mother's fear had assisted her in meeting her most necessary goals. She had no reason to believe it might kill her until it tried to do just that. I called Mitch and Becky, the parents I was babysitting for, and asked if it would be okay for me to drive their two boys an hour and a half away to my hometown. I told them I wanted to check on my mother. They said, of course, and asked if I needed help with anything. I told them that I would be fine, and I believed myself when I said it. Over time, this family had become my second family, filling numerous holes in parental guidance, but I was still wary. When you don't grow up with a certain kind of affection, even if you know you're worthy of it, it can be hard to accept in adulthood. I was no different than the statistics on these matters. They loved me, and I knew it. I loved them, and I knew that too. I'm pretty sure they did as well. But I could not understand their trust or forgiveness. They were not obligated to me by blood, and so I could not fathom why or how they could love me unconditionally. I still wasn't sure if I was loved unconditionally by the people who were supposedly obligated to do so. Because I could not understand it, I could not believe it. And so, I continued to accept their love for as long as they would have me. However, for various reasons, I did not expect they would have me for long. I packed the boys into their parents' van with snacks, toys, and a host of other distractions. They were good kids, but at 5 and 2, still quite young. They fought sometimes, yelled sometimes, and got bored and antsy. But they were good listeners, and though I tended to hold adults to impossible standards, I seemed to have infinite patience for children. Unlike some adults, I never quit remembering what it was like to be one. Their small plights were familiar to me, as were their big feelings. I didn't feel like a child, but I felt children. These two were among my favorites. On this trip, the boys were mostly silent. I told them that we were going to visit my family, my mother specifically, but I hadn't told them why. It was as if they knew I needed the quiet to think and provided it easily without being bribed or nagged. It was a gift, purposeful or not, and I was grateful to them. I don't remember the ride to the hospital, but I do remember our arrival into my mother's room. I knew she was sick. I had prepared to hear whatever it would be necessary for me to hear about the state of her health, her prospects, her fate. Still, somehow, in that hour and a half drive all the way there, I had not prepared to see her. My mother's gorgeous dark skin had taken on a gray pallor unlike anything I'd ever seen. Her eyes were bloodshot, and she squinted as if she were newly sensitive to the light. Her body filled the bed, but the formidable woman who raised me was missing. The woman who lay there, with my mother's name typed in small print onto the plastic band around her wrist, was dying. The formidable woman who raised me would have done no such thing. I wanted to be angry. Instead, I was deeply, startlingly sad. "What are you doing here?" my mother asked, her voice raspy and weak. She was shocked to see me. Only then did I realize I hadn't told my grandmother or any other member of my family I was on my way. I'd spent half the drive there coming up with a plan for moving back and taking care of my youngest brother, who was only 13 years old, and making sure my sister wouldn't have to drop out of college. And yet, I hadn't picked up the phone and called either of them. "I talked to Grandma," I said. "Don't tell me what she said." I sighed. "Okay." The boys were small enough to sit together in the only chair in the room. From the bag I'd secretly packed, I handed them each an iPad and a Game Boy. Preemptive bribes for silence. I sat on the windowsill. My mother smiled at me, her still recognizable smile, and I remembered to kiss her cheek. We talked for a bit. She asked how it had been babysitting the boys, and I asked about her work. I didn't reach out to her or my siblings enough, so I rarely knew what everyone had been up to. I was preoccupied with my life in my college town. I was afraid we'd grown too far apart, that my brothers and sister might not want to talk to me anyway. In our own ways, my mother and I talked to one another about our fear, which is to say, we didn't say much of anything to one another at all. After a few minutes of our non-talking, a nurse popped in to tell my mother her doctor had ordered another test. Technicians would be arriving soon to move her to a lab. My mother looked terrified. She told the nurse, "My mother will be here soon. If they find anything, if they suspect anything, don't tell me. Tell my mother." The confused nurse nodded slowly, looked at me, and when she saw I had nothing more to offer than a shrug, turned on her heels and made her exit. I told my mother I'd stay until the techs arrived, and almost as soon as the words left my mouth, they did. I kissed her graying cheeks again and attempted an awkward hug through the rails on her bed. We both said, "I love you," and she told me to be safe on the road. The techs descended on her and moved fast. They were out the door before I could finish packing up the boys and their things. By the time I turned back around, the room was empty in a way that forced me to swallow my stomach. Looking down at the unnaturally white floors didn't help. I stared at the door with a small child's hand in each of my hands. We were all quiet. For the first time in my memory, I felt like I hadn't had enough time with my mother. As we hit the highway, the boys asked me to turn on the radio. I did, to some popular local station, and they began to sing nonsense at the tops of their lungs. It didn't bother me. It sounded like a joy I couldn't feel anymore, but sometimes I remembered it. It made me think of my mother, who sang at the tops of her lungs every chance she got, and how this was my favorite version of her. When she sang that way, she seemed happy and unafraid. My mother wasn't perfect. Our relationship was complicated and difficult. She was my imperfect mother. We were two different people and found that hard to accept in one another. But I was hers, and she was mine. That's how it had always been. Who would I be if not hers? I didn't want to be without her. It was then on the road, with two boys screaming from the back of my borrowed van, that I promised myself I would visit my father for the first time in 13 years. I was afraid. I could admit that. But I wasn't going to let fear kill me too. Chapter 27. After a few close calls and two surgeries, my mother did not die. I was relieved. I was ecstatic. I could not forget her dark gray face lit up by the dead white hospital room or her weak smile. I did not forget my fear of becoming parentless. I did not forget my promise. It took mailing a 5-page form and a large photocopy of my driver's license before I became an approved visitor for Indiana State Prisons. Months before, my father wrote me a letter saying I was on his visitors list. He'd written this information into every letter he'd sent me since I'd been old enough to drive. It had always seemed easy enough to do, despite the fact that I was an anxious driver. I was afraid of highways, and driving alone anywhere more than 30 minutes away scared me. Operating a vehicle is a lesson in individual control and mutual trust. I was skeptical of both. Still, it seemed the desire to see him, to speak to him, which had been boiling over for the better part of 2 decades, should have been enough to get me to hit the road. It wasn't. It was the near death of my mother. I couldn't pinpoint one thing that kept me from visiting my father for so long. I had my suspicions, of course. Could I have been so lazy? Could he mean so little to me that I couldn't be bothered? There was some truth to both of these explanations. There is a lot of work that goes into visiting a prison, and I had no interest in doing that work. When someone you can't remember being physically involved in your life asks for physical involvement in your life, it is hard to know where and how to make room for them. I was 25 years old before I decided to make room for my father. The weight of this lingering choice should have shamed me, but the high of possibility, the potential for what kind of man my father might be, persisted. I did not have time to be ashamed. I was far too busy dreaming about our inevitable reunion and his inevitable adoration of the woman his daughter had become. After I found out I'd been approved as a visitor, I called Trent. I thought healing from our respective breakups might eventually separate us, but we were still here. 2 years earlier, he'd offered to take me to see my father as a Christmas present. I wasn't sure if the offer still stood, but I had to ask. I believed if I didn't ask him right then, I never would. Driving myself was out of the question. I was already nervous behind the wheel and could vividly imagine how that nervousness might bloom, compounded with the reality of seeing my father for the first time in 13 years. It had been easier to drive to see my mother. I knew who she was, and I knew the way home. That knowledge allowed me enough comfort to feel however I needed to along the way. There was also this. It had to be the right person. Other friends could have driven me, but I didn't want them to. It had to be someone with a nature to nurture. Someone who would deeply understand how much I would need them to be gentle with me on the way, in the moment, and especially upon our return. Truly, there was no better option. When Trent answered the phone, I told him if he was still willing to drive me to the prison, I was ready to go. He said, "Of course, I'd love to." The flood of relief that flowed through me was quickly replaced by anxiety. It was all working out. This was going to happen. If I wasn't ready, it was time to get ready. But I had no idea what ready looked like in this situation. And no one else seemed to know either. Friends made low-stakes recommendations. "You should talk to your therapist about this. A lot. You should write him ahead of time and make sure he knows you're coming. You should tell your mother you're going. You should take a shot of whiskey before you go in. Are you on antidepressants? You might want to ask about antidepressants. You should bring something with you that he can keep. Oh, wait, can you do that?" Don't tell him ahead of time. Everybody loves surprises. And he probably doesn't get a lot of them. Unfortunately, or fortunately, Trent was moving to Denver at the end of the month, so the visit had to be soon. There was no time for me to send a letter or plan much at all. The day that worked best for us both was 1 week away from the day I called him. My father was 1 week away. I thanked Trent over and over. More than once he said, "This is such a big deal. I can't believe you chose me to do this with you." I would smile up at him and think, "I wish I didn't have to make any choices ever again. This could be my last good one, and I'd be happy with that." 1 week away felt sooner than it was, but I knew myself. If I had not set the wheels in motion immediately, I would have found 1,000,005 reasons why I couldn't make the trip. No money for gas, hating the highways, not actually knowing what my father would be like when I got there. There are always excuses to be made, and I had been making them for 7 years. Since I was 18 years old and legally able to make this trip on my own, now I would not be alone. I'd sent in all the paperwork, and I'd asked my close friend to be my support system. I was still afraid, but I was not alone. I'd started writing about my father that same year, what I knew of him anyway, and I couldn't stop. There was only one question that preoccupied me, kept me awake at night, and simmered under the surface of my skin like no other branch of curiosity had. This was the question I most needed answered, and the only one that couldn't possibly be answered beforehand. After 13 years of not seeing one another face to face and not hearing one another's voices, what would my father think of me? The oldest letter I had from my father was dated in 1991. I would have been 4 years old and just beginning to learn to read, but he didn't care. He had things he needed to say to me. He has been writing me for as long as I can remember. Letter upon letter filled with, "I love you, I'm proud of you, smile, you're beautiful, you're so smart," and a host of other things every young girl wants to hear from her dad. Most girls got to hear those words in person, but I thought his way was better. The most important questions were answered. Did my father love me? Yes, I had it in writing. I had it in writing over and over again. The letters, notes, and birthday cards came all year long. I would come home from school and grab the mail right out of our box, or I would riffle through the pile my mother always set on the kitchen counter closest to the front door. Many days, there were only bills, notices, or junk mail. Every once in a while, every few months or so, there would be two letters, one addressed to me and the other to my brother. The handwriting would be perfect. I would instantly be motivated to work on my chicken scratch a little harder in school. But it would never be as graceful as his. The heavier the envelope, the better. The thickness implied the inclusion of a hand-drawn card, or at the very least, a longer, more revealing message. My father was a mystery, and his letters were the clues to where I'd come from, why I was the way I was. I would take my letter to my bedroom to open privately. For many years, I did not write him back. I'm sure I had my reasons why I didn't write. I couldn't remember any of them now. Chapter 28. The morning I left to see my father, I wore my favorite striped top and the jeans that actually fit. Nothing fancy, but still nice. I wasn't sure how he'd feel about my natural hair, but there was nothing I could do about that now, nor did I want to. I was also clearly at least 20 pounds overweight. I hoped he would look past it, that he could look past it. My beloved rhino necklace, a small token of strength, stayed on my bedside table. Visitors weren't allowed to wear jewelry. I was dressed and ready to go an hour before Trent was due to arrive. I lay on my side in bed, my hands tucked between my thighs for warmth, waiting for his text. When my phone lit up on the nightstand, I almost fell out of my bed, scrambling for it. The words, "I'm here," only added to the tension coursing through my body. I checked my bag for the 15th time. Driver's license? Check. Keys? Check. Notebook to write down important thoughts in the car? Check. Valium? I wished. I met Trent at the bottom of the stairs. He pulled me into a hug and breathed into my hair for a moment. My charging heart stilled a bit, just enough for me to take a deep breath, the first one of the day. When he released me from the calming embrace, he grabbed my hand. "Thank you so much for letting me do this for you, Ashley." When we got to his car, there was a flower sitting on the seat for me. Halfway there, he asked when was the last time I saw my father, and I told him it'd been 13 years. "Has he had any visitors since then?" I rolled down the window and considered his question. "I don't know. I hope so." I kept my face just outside the window frame, allowing the air to whip around my nose, mouth, and closed eyes. It reminded me of being a child and jumping off the swings at the playground. Even when I was scared, I wouldn't open my eyes. Sometimes I landed poorly, but it felt better that way. Trent spoke again. 13 years is a long time not to see anybody you love. I rolled the window back up. I don't think it's been 13 years. I didn't know if this was true, but I hoped. It was one thing not to see your father for 13 years. It was quite another for him not to have seen one familiar face in 13 years. If I was going to be the first loving face he saw in over a decade, I wished I had a perfect face. The drive to the prison was shorter than I thought it'd be, or hoped it'd be. Only about an hour and a half. The facility looked the way you'd expect a prison to look. Everything was a flat, concrete gray and a sickening, yellow-leaning beige. Trent dropped me off at the door. Waiting in the parking lot wasn't allowed, so he'd have to find some place to hang out by himself in the middle of nowhere. I rummaged around in my bag for all my quarters. I'd brought $10 worth. I knew you could bring change for the vending machines, and sometimes you could use them to take a picture with your loved one. I wanted a picture more than I wanted anything else. The only photo I had of myself with my father was 13 years old. I also wanted to be able to buy him a cookie. RC had always had an insatiable appetite for sweet things. If you brought a treat into the house, you'd better hide it, or he would find it and eat it without remorse. When we were younger, my mother would shake her head and say, "Just like your daddy, you and these sweets." My mother never said anything bad to us about our father, but over the years, she talked about him less and less. I assumed it was because she'd run out of things to say. They hadn't been married for very long before he went to prison. Maybe she'd told us everything she knew. I didn't know what it meant to have a broken heart. I was unfamiliar with longing and despair. It did not resonate with me that the father I'd never really known was also the husband she lost. I did not know that there are miles between running out of things to say and running out of the strength to say them. Still trying to leave Trent's car, nervousness radiated around me. I kept dropping the quarters, starting to leave the car, then stopping to check and make sure I had everything I needed again. It was as if I'd thrown my momentum out the window somewhere along the road. It didn't feel right. It felt sudden. I was still afraid. I still had questions, and I wasn't sure I could make it out of the car with everything I needed. Trent leaned over and placed his steady hand over mine. I looked toward him, and he smiled. "It's going to be good. You've waited a long time for this. Tell him I said hello." Again, my heart stilled. I put all the quarters in my pocket and finally stepped out of the car. My chest tightened on the walk to the door, but I remembered to breathe deeply. The waiting room was full of foot-tapping visitors. The chairs looked like the hard plastic Fisher-Price furniture that gets passed down over and over in working-class families. As soon as your cousins were too big for it, ta-da! You just inherited some bite-sized kiddie furniture perfect for playing pretend and not messing up your mother's good table when you ate. Its blue-gray coloring looked dirty to me. The two officers working the sign-in booth were busy doing a job made for more than just two people, and they knew it. "Don't be any trouble and you'll be fine." Internally, my pep talks were thin and already guilt-ridden. I was certain I would do something to mess this up for my father and me. As I stuffed my bag into a locker that cost me 4 of my quarters, I checked and rechecked to make sure I hadn't forgotten my ID. I hadn't. But I checked again. In the long line to add your name to the waiting list, I watched a woman get frustrated with the officers. She'd brought her cell phone into the facility, and apparently that was not allowed. It wasn't just something you couldn't take into the visiting room. It was something you weren't allowed to have in the building at all. She would have to walk it back to her car, then come back in and find a place at the end of the line again. It was only then that I noticed the signage all around the room. No cell phones allowed on premises. Leave cell phones in your car. You may be asked to leave if cell phone found on your person. My fingers twitched toward the cell phone I'd forgotten to silence in my pocket. I prayed it wouldn't ring while I was so close to giving the officers my father's and my names. When I got to the front of the line, I answered every question quickly, then raced back to my locker to silence and hide my phone. I would have taken it out to the parking lot, except that Trent wouldn't be there, and if I left the waiting room, I might miss them call my name. I considered burying it in the gravel on either side of the sidewalk and just digging it out when I was done with my visit. Instead, I just sat and wondered if they'd search the lockers while I was talking to my dad, if they'd pull me out of our reunion because I hadn't noticed the signs about the cell phones until it was too late. I pictured myself being grabbed by the officers and dragged away from him. I knew it was terribly dramatic, but I couldn't shake the image. The other picture in my mind was of my dad, fighting them all, eyes blazing, warning them through clenched teeth, "Take your hands off my daughter." I felt worried and proud and protected thinking of it. Despite everything my father had done, I was still so eager to be claimed by him, to be protected by him. To the world, he was a bad man. To me, he was my dad who did a bad thing. I was still trying to figure out what it meant to love someone who had done such a bad thing. But I did love him, and that was enough for me to show up and say so to his face. I couldn't sit, so instead, I paced. I counted backward from 100. I picked at my clothes so much I thought they might check me for fleas before they allowed me inside. I jumped when they called my father's last name, my last name. It was time to go in for my visit. I went through the pat-down and the metal detector. Then the female officer asked the male officer if I was allowed to wear my headband in. He shook his head. She said I'd have to put it back in my locker and get back in line. I took it off and handed it to her. Just throw it away.
Are you sure?
Absolutely. She looked at me like I might be a nut job and threw it away in the garbage can at her feet. In that moment, I didn't care what my father thought of the way I looked. I wanted him to see me. She handed me a plastic tub for my shoes, belt, and quarters, then opened the big heavy door in front of me. I walked through, putting my belt and shoes back on after the door closed behind me. When I'd gathered the last of my quarters from the bin, a second large door opened for me to enter. I held my breath and stepped inside. Once I entered the room, I scanned the crowd of tables for my father. I'd stared at the few pictures I had of him enough to recognize him anywhere. I was no longer that little girl sitting on my grandmother's bed, not knowing who her daddy was. His face was burned into my brain as much as my own. Another officer directed me to a log sheet. I signed my name quickly, nearly dropping the pen. My hands were shaking. By the time I turned back around, my dad was standing up. My tears came swiftly. My first instinct was to run to him, but I was mindful enough to realize that running in a prisoner visitation room might be on the list of shit you don't do in a prison. I walked calmly, if eagerly, toward him. He held his arms wide open and smiled. Then I sprinted. My right cheek landed directly in the middle of his chest. He squeezed me tightly and kissed the top of my head, my forehead. He knew me. He whispered into my hair, "I love you, I love you, I love you." There was his voice. It was deep and sincere. It made so much sense why I loved talking to my Uncle Clarence, my father's younger brother, so much. They sounded almost identical. "I love you too, Daddy." I had told myself before I got there that I would refer to him as Dad because I was not a child. I was a grown woman, and I was pretty sure grown women didn't call their fathers Daddy. But in that moment, I felt like someone's little girl, and I'd been waiting a long time to feel like somebody's daughter. He walked me to our seating area. He looked at me and smiled. He was handsome. I looked so much like him, much more so in person than in pictures. It was startling and familiar, and I promised myself that I would make it a memory. I would not forget how this felt, to notice how much I looked like my father, to feel this sameness in our blood and countenance and capacity for love. My father loved me as much in person as he did in his letters, maybe even more. He held my hands as long as he was allowed, which was 5 minutes for every 30 minutes. He spoke to me softly, as if the full volume of his emotions might scare me away. It quickly became apparent that he was trying to put his best foot forward as much as I was trying to do the same. We were in awe and terrified of one another. He leaned toward me, his words low and hesitant. "I could sit here and stare at you all day, Ashley, but we ain't got but a couple hours. Let's talk." "Okay." I thought about every question I'd wanted to ask him, important and poignant questions. Instead, I said, "What have you been up to?" I regretted the question immediately. I had asked a man who had been in prison for 24 years the unabridged version of "What's up?" I assumed it made me look dumb, or worse, uninteresting. My father smiled. "Not much today, but I've been up to a few things here or there since the last time I saw you." He filled me in quickly. While incarcerated, he'd earned 2 degrees, an associate's in art and a bachelor's in business. He read voraciously. He was a funny guy, really funny. Inside, that's what he was known for: scholarship, art, and his sense of humor. And he loved me. He loved me and my brother and my mother. He missed us. He drew us all the time. He had photos of us taped to the wall in his cell. Sometimes, he said, we were the only thing keeping him alive. I was the first person to visit him in 5 years. His father, my grandpa Jay, had attempted to visit him 5 years earlier and had suffered a heart attack behind the wheel. Since then, there'd been no one, not his brothers, his sister, cousins, aunts, uncles, or his children. The love he hoped we had for him sustained him, though he could not see it. He looked around to see where the guards were standing, and when he was certain the coast was clear, he grabbed my hands again. My father is one of the few people I know whose hands are bigger than mine. "I knew it was you." "What do you mean?" "When they told me I had a visitor, they couldn't say who it was, but I knew. If anybody loved me enough to come into this hellhole, it would be my baby girl." The first question he asked me was, "Is my daughter happy?" Because that was what was most important to him. I said yes, because it was mostly true. The parts of my life that weren't happy, I wasn't ready to talk about. Not with him. Not yet. There was nothing he could do about them, and I hadn't yet figured out if there was something I could do about them. My father and I sat and talked for 2 hours and 47 minutes about anything we could think of in the moment. We covered politics, both of us were progressive, religion, he believed in God, I didn't, and even relationships, We were both happily single. I asked him about his relationships before he married my mother. He told me that he had been in love with someone else before he met my mother, but it was complicated. He would tell me more in a letter. I laughed more than I cried, but I did cry. He sneakily held my hands here and there. He spoke to me with the weight of a sincerity I'd never known. It frightened me. In every story he told, I could tell he had been waiting to say those exact words to me for 13 years, perhaps longer. He'd thought it through, what kind of conversation he would want to have with me. He'd maybe even practiced. He knew I would come, and he would not let himself be so overwhelmed that he could not say all that he wanted to say. We were alike, my father and I. After telling a joke about the man he shared a cell with, a joke that made me laugh from the center of my belly, my father got serious and quiet. "Do you need anything from me, Ashley? Anything at all? I know I can't do much from here, but if you need something, I'll do whatever I can to get it to you." My voice caught in my throat, then I coughed up the question I needed to ask. "I've been writing about you. Well, really about me. But a lot of it has to do with how I feel about you. But not just you. Actually, it's about me being a kid, a little girl, and all the stuff that goes with that. And I use passages from some of your letters when I write about what they mean to me or how they made me feel. Is that okay? Me writing about you? I don't want to stop." He put his hand up to stop me from explaining. He sat back in his chair and released a breath that caused his whole body, shoulders down, to sink farther into his baggy tan uniform. "When you sent me one of your stories, I thought, damn, I must be the luckiest fool in the world. I got me a daughter who's smart, beautiful, and she's a writer, a real one. A good one. I'm so proud of you, Ashley." "Thanks, Daddy." I stared at my palms, unable to look him in the eye. He sat forward and, without looking around, put his palm in mine. "So look, I don't know what all you're writing. And maybe it'll make me sound too good, but that's not your fault. That's on me. This is something I can give you if you need it. You need my permission? You got it." I looked at him. I don't know what I'd expected. I guess I hadn't even expected to ask him that particular question. But his permission gave me direction. "Hands off!" A guard glared at my father, and he released my hands, mumbling under his breath, "These motherfuckers, trying to talk to my daughter." I did not want to think of my father as a violent man, though his incarceration was the result of his capacity for violence. I wanted to believe that had he been a free man, he would have been a fierce guardian, and I wouldn't have ever been forced to endure all the times I couldn't bring myself to tell him about. I couldn't reconcile these two desires. I thought I would have learned by now. The machine used to take pictures was broken, so we didn't get to take a photo. I wasn't ready to leave when we were told our time was up. I couldn't imagine how I would ever be ready to leave. There was still so much to say. My father and I hugged. He walked me to the front of the visiting room. He squeezed me one last time and sat in the designated seat for prisoners to return to wherever they came from on the inside. Separate from the rest of us. Separate from me. In most cases, I was glad to be separated from the dangerous criminals I saw in the news and in the papers. This day, it felt cruel. I waited in the line of people leaving their loved ones, most of us weeping. I turned frequently to look back and wave at him as he waited. He was always smiling, staring at me, waiting to wave back. There in case I needed him. I was turning back for the umpteenth time when he said my name. He opened his mouth, then closed it again. He wanted to say something he hadn't prepared. Do me a favor, Ashley. When you write about you and me, just tell the truth. Your truth. Don't worry about nobody's feelings, especially not mine. You gotta be tough to tell your truth, but it's the only thing worth doing next to loving somebody. I nodded through my tears. Okay, Daddy. Just then the door opened and the visitors began filing into another world, the outside world. I turned and blew him a kiss. He pretended to catch it. That was the